90.1 KPFT FM and FM HD 1 Houston, your community station. My co-host is Andrew Ferguson.
Hi there.
We are going to start this quarter hour talking about coronavirus in Houston, water bill spikes, developments in Montrose, and the I-45 overhaul proposal. First, we're going to begin to remind you that we have early voting starting April 19th, which is only like 5 weeks away. Make sure you're registered. Also, because of COVID, if you are late in registering your car, you have until April 13th. So if it expired like in December, like, you know, me, you have until April 13th to get your car inspected and registered. So the first four stories, I'm going to have to credit communityimpact.com. All four stories are from the same reporter, Emma Whalen, and in the interest of full disclosure, I'm now a monthly subscriber and I pay money. It's only fair to let you know that. But these are, I mean, this lady is working hard. First story, Houston coronavirus UK variant is present throughout the city, new data confirms. So the UK variant, which early research indicates causes more severe symptoms and spreads faster, is present throughout most of the city of Houston. Preliminary data shows that as of February 22nd, the UK variant made up 19% of the total amount of COVID-19 virus present in the city. On March 8th, Houston Emergency Medical Director David Peirce said, to some degree, the race is on to get as many people vaccinated as possible to prevent another surge. So there's been a lot of discussion about this now, where the longer people go unvaccinated and the more community spread there is, the more opportunity there is for viral mutation. So you want to stop spread by vaccination to reduce mutation into types of virus that are even more contagious and even more virulent and perhaps even more fatal.
Right. And that makes sense with everything that I've been hearing, all the advice about when you should get your vaccine. Get it as soon as you can. Because A, you're only going to be contributing to herd immunity. You're only going to be helping people with that. There is no reason to, like, you know, not get the vaccine because somebody else should have it before you, because everybody who's in, who's vaccinated helps, you know. So
you want to get vaccinated as soon as you fairly can. And, you know, a thing for concern is that according to recent polls, as many as 40% of Americans have doubts about whether they should get vaccinated. And to have 40% unvaccinated, and we're not even sure that some of these variants can't reinfect you after you've had one variant of COVID, a 60% vaccination rate is not enough to protect everybody. It's not even enough to definitely protect the people that have been vaccinated.
That's
because
true.
A variant can work around the vaccination perhaps at some point. So it really is important that people set aside their concerns. There's going to be a tiny fraction of people that have reactions. It's like crossing the street, you know, or driving to work. You just, for the good of everybody, for the good of yourself, your family, your city, your state, your country, you have to try to set aside concerns you might have and get vaccinated.
The problem is that communities of color might be apprehensive about getting the COVID-19 vaccine because they've historically been mistreated by the medical community. But to me, it's important that the medical community assuages those fears so that those people can get the vaccine and build herd immunity, because that is extremely important.
Great. Okay, the next story, also from communityimpact.com. Houston City Council okays a measure to prevent water bill spikes caused by what we are apparently calling Winter Storm Uri. An estimated 25% of Houston households experienced a leak or disruption of water service during Winter Storm Uri, according to Houston Public Works. As a new billing cycle approaches, Houston City Council approved a measure on March 10th to prevent a spike in water bills from meters registering and overcharging residents for leaking water. A previous ordinance in place only covered 50% of a bill increase related to leaks, but this was expanded by City Council to fully cover leak-related costs in February. According to Eric Dunn, Houston Public Works Assistant Director, the current ordinance was insufficient in addressing the magnitude and impact of the winter storm. For residents in single-family homes, all water bills will be automatically adjusted to either the same amount they paid in the previous month or the average amount for the 12 months preceding the storm. The department will bill residents the lesser of the two amounts. For apartment complexes and multifamily buildings, property managers will need to apply for an adjusted bill through Houston Public Works. And if you go to Houston, if you go to thinkwingradio.com, there is a link to houstonwaterbills.org that will take you to the place you need to go.
Wish Pearland would do that. And
maybe they will.
Maybe they will. Go to your city. Yeah, go to your city website. Check. See if you've got any bill forgiveness.
City, county, whatever works for you. Next story has to do with Montrose. You know, there's been a lot of talk over the years, and not only regarding Montrose, how gentrification forces people of lesser financial means to relocate to areas further from Center City, further from where they work. And there is a group called Montrose TIRZ, the Livable Centers Plan for Long-Term Investments in Affordable Housing and Infrastructure. Again, communityimpact.com. A new roadmap for investments in infrastructure and affordable housing in Montrose was finalized on March 8th. And this is where the abbreviation comes in. The Montrose Tax Increment Reinvestment Zone, or TIRZ, that's the acronym. Is that an acronym? What was it? What was the other term you used earlier?
Initialism.
Initialism, a new
now, one. Now that's what I call an initialism.
That's what you call, and correctly, I think, an initialism. But in any case, TIRZ has been working with urban design consultants for over a year to collect feedback from community members, businesses, and local officials. The end result, the Livable Centers Plan, was presented publicly for the first time March 8th and outlined strategies for preserving the neighborhood's identity as a bohemian enclave while managing new growth. According to Montrose TIRZ Chair Joe Webb, God, that's an acronym or an initialism. If we do this correctly, he says, when you see the streets, the greenways, and the pedestrian right-of-way, you'll know you're in Montrose. You won't need a sign. You'll know it because of the way the neighborhood looks and feels. Look and feel is an interesting thing because it's intangible and yet perceptible. It's a very curious thing. The Montrose TIRZ is funded through a portion of property tax collections within its defined boundaries. The Livable Centers Plan serves as a guide for how the TIRZ can best, God, every time I say that, can best utilize its funds. The plan lays out goals for restoring neighborhoods' affordability, promoting artists and small businesses, managing the effects of climate change, and improving mobility for pedestrians and drivers. I am now a driver more than a pedestrian, so it matters to me. A right to return, this is significant, a right to return policy would require any housing development that uses TIRZ funds to prioritize units for prospective residents who have previously been displaced from the community due to the rising cost of living, said Jeff Reichman, an analyst with data analytics and public policy firm January Advisor. So, I mean, this, if it's actually implemented the way it sounds, this is a very significant development, literally and figuratively.
And that right to return policy is, I'm very much in favor of that.
I've never heard of that in a city development or redevelopment before. So this may be a unique or novel idea.
Yeah. I mean, you know, gentrification is all about, you know, kicking people out of what is their home and making it like explicit efforts to bring those people back is great.
Well, of course, it's more insidious than kicking them out of their home. You simply make their home less affordable. Sometimes right. they're kicked out if it goes condo or whatever.
Right.
But mostly it just becomes too expensive, the rent or the taxes or whatever. So, interesting idea. The next one is, again, from communityimpact.com. Harris County is suing TxDOT, the Texas Department of Transportation, over I-45 overhaul proposal. Now, we've talked about this in the past because they're talking about basically removing the current I-45 section going downtown, rerouting I-45 so that it conjoins with I-69 and diverting it to the east side of town. But, you know, then they would have things like, are they going to have a green space and an undercut and all this kind of business? So the lawsuit from Houston alleges that TxDOT failed to adequately consider the full environmental ramifications of the project in its final environmental impact statement, which is a federally required step. The announcement comes after over a year of advocacy from various groups such as the Make I-45 Better Coalition and the Stop TxDOT I-45 group. Both have expressed concern over the impact of the project on neighborhoods in the east end and north side of Houston, where the proposed reroute expansion of I-45 would displace over 900 residences, 300 businesses, 5 places of worship, and 2 schools. Local officials have repeatedly made attempts to influence the project. Beginning in 2019, the city of Houston led a separate public input process, which resulted in proposed alternatives to the plan, including one in which the 1960s era highway would be upgraded for safety improvements, but maintain its current footprint. Important because you're not talking about dividing and dislocating a new community. After the agency's final environmental impact statement was issued in September 2020, critics of the plan noted that it failed to incorporate many of the recommendations identified through the city's public input process. Proponents of the project have said it will ease congestion. Proponents of the TxDOT project have said that it would ease congestion, particularly for commuters, update the highway's safety, and mitigate flooding issues along its path. TxDOT officials have said they will continue to accept and incorporate feedback. A TxDOT executive said, "We were looking forward to continuing our work with stakeholders on refining the plan, blah, 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 blah." I mean, we know how that goes. On February 4th, the Texas Department of Transportation issued its record of decision, signaling one of the final hurdles before construction can begin.
I don't remember who came up with the green space plan that we looked at.
That was, I think, part of the TxDOT plan.
Was that maybe. Part of the, okay, that's interesting.
Maybe. You know, I don't recall, but yeah. It is in one of our prior shows, so you can search the website.
It's sure in one of them. It's important to make sure that the, you know, public works projects like this are done fairly and are done equitably. And I wonder what the proposals of these groups that are opposing TxDOT's plan, I wonder what their proposals, how they're going to differ.
Well, I mean, I can't speak to that directly, of course, but I frankly was surprised and a little, I'm going to say as a driver, annoyed that they were going to basically reroute all of the I-45 downtown traffic to the east side. It is, you know, it's kind of complicated because it has to do with 288 joining up and 59 joining up. But it also strikes me as a significant detour. Mm. And this doesn't even count the fact that you would be rerouting a whole community along with the highway. So, personally, I would rather see them improve the highway in its existing footprint. But, I mean, I'm not an engineer. I haven't gone through all the civic comments and whatnot. But just sort of off the top of my head, if you will, it just seems to me like that makes in some ways more sense. Don't know. Okay. After the break, we're going to be talking about whether abortion should be punishable by the death penalty. We're also going to be looking at whether Dan Patrick might run for governor, whether Lubbock really wants to join ERCOT at this point in time. So we've got some other stories following our break. You are listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on 90.1 FM KPFT. As we mentioned a little while ago, you can follow my blog at thinkwingradio.com. I do extensive show posts, very often including a lot more contextual or informational stuff that we don't cover here on the show. You can also follow me on Twitter at ThinkWing Radio. You can also follow me on Facebook at ThinkWing Radio, because I have absolutely no imagination. And of course, Andrew can be followed.
Yes, you can find me on Twitter at DominateEYE and on Tumblr, spelled the same, at DominateEye.tumblr.com.
And it would not be fair of me to leave out the fact that you can also go to KPFT.org and follow the station, follow the shows, go to the archive, listen to shows that maybe aren't live, but going back anywhere from 2 to 8 weeks, depending on the show. And you can podcast many shows. So just a lot to do at kpft.org. You really should drop by and see. And, oh, by the way, there's a donate link.
Yeah, and you can check out our new station logo as well.
Ooh, our new station logo. It is so pretty.
Yes, thank you to Bonsi Lal Ketki, KPFT listener, for designing that logo. It looks great.
It's so colorful. And after 50 years, it really was time. Okay. This next story you can file under Elections Have Consequences. Title, and this is from the Texas Tribune, another Texas GOP lawmaker is attempting to make abortion punishable by the death penalty. Similar bills filed in the Texas ledge in previous years have failed. A Texas lawmaker has filed the bill to abolish and criminalize abortions, leaving women and physicians who perform the procedure to face criminal charges that could carry the death penalty. The legislation was filed by Representative Brian Slayton, does not include exceptions for rape or incest. It does exempt ectopic pregnancies. What a guy. When a reasonable alternative to save the lives of both the mother and the unborn child are unavailable. He says it is time for Texas to protect the natural right to life for the tiniest and most innocent Texans, and this bill does just that. It's the Republic. It's time Republicans make it clear that we actually think abortion is murder. Unborn children are dying at a faster rate in Texas than COVID patients, but Texas isn't taking the abortion crisis seriously. I might insert here that I'm sure he votes for the death penalty, and I'm sure he is very strict when it comes to Medicaid and SNAP for kids. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that if, you know, parents are poor and the kids are going hungry, he's chill with that. Because Republicans are very concerned about before you're born and after you die, in the middle, you're on your own.
They're pro-birth rather than pro-life. Yeah.
Yes, they are pro-birth and pro-respect for the dead. Mm. Yeah, okay, we're not even going to try to do that. Similar measures have in the past been filed by State Representative Tony Tinderholt, Republican of Arlington, who received death threats and was placed under protection of the Texas Department of Public Safety after he introduced the bill in 2017. The legislation did not receive a hearing. The bill bans, this new bill, Slayton, bans abortions starting at fertilization. Slayton, a freshman Republican from Royce City, previously tried to stop the House from naming bridges or streets without first voting to abolish abortion. The amendment failed, but was supported by more than 40 lawmakers, about half of the Republicans in the House. I think I've already made my comments, Andrew.
Yeah. You can't see it, but you should see how hard I rolled my eyes there. do I have to say that, like, comparing aborted fetuses to, like, deaths from COVID is so disrespectful and, like, heartless? Do I have to say that? I don't think I do.
They cherish the pre-birth.
Yeah. Yeah.
After that, you're on your own. Okay. The next story is also from the Texas Tribune. Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick focuses scorn on Public Utility Commission after winter storm, testing Governor Greg Abbott. So there's a lot in the article about Dan Patrick's involvement in Texas Senate hearings and how it's unusual for a lieutenant governor to be that involved because he's not actually in the Senate. But I think the most interesting part of the story is this bit. What is driving the dynamic is the source of growing speculation in Austin. There is a political backdrop. Patrick has never been able to fully shake rumors that he is interested in the governor's office, despite insisting he would never run against Abbott and repeatedly saying he plans to run for a third term as lieutenant governor in 2022. Now, what are the implications of Patrick running for governor. First of all, if he chooses to run for governor, he'll have to vacate his job as lieutenant governor regardless of the outcome. He may be provoked to run because of Abbott's perceived vulnerability, maybe incompetence, related to the ERCOT situation and the winter freeze situation. And this may be seen by Patrick and others, perhaps even, as Abbott becoming uniquely vulnerable politically in a 2022 election cycle. Next, in a Republican primary for the governor's candidacy, only one of them can get the spot on the ballot. So either Abbott or Patrick would then be out of the picture politically speaking. The winner of that primary would then have to stand in a general election against the Democrat, and of course, as Andrew would no doubt mention, others. That means that someone else would be running for the to-be-vacant lieutenant governor spot, and then those people would have to stand in primaries and run in the general. So this presents the very interesting prospect in 2 years of a significant turnover at the top of Texas government, regardless of how things turn out. If Patrick decides to run, everything changes. The Democrats might become competitive, but at the very least, you would end up with different Republicans in these various jobs, which, you know, elections have consequences. So we would just have to see what happened there. Okay, also from Texas Tribune, and this is almost like a stand-up comedy joke. After Texas's power grid failure, some in Lubbock worry about the city's plans to join ERCOT. The city made plans to join ERCOT in 2015, but after last month's winter storm, some feel anxious about the move. Lubbock is one of the few areas of the state not connected to Texas's independent power grid. And the plan for Lubbock to join the Texas grid has been in the works for 5 or 6 years now. Already millions of dollars have been poured into constructing transmission lines. But as ERCOT leaders have been cast as villains of the February disaster, more officials are pushing back against the move, and many residents. Many Lubbock officials are still optimistic about joining ERCOT, optimistic being a word I might have chosen differently, which isn't regulated by the federal government. They're hoping the Texas legislature's proposed reforms, hoping being the key word, will prevent another disaster from occurring, kind of like it did after 2011 when they did such a great job of reforming. But they haven't ruled out pushing for a delay if it appears winterization efforts are faltering. But here's the thing. This is scheduled, as near as I can get from the article, to be implemented in late May of this year. It's mid-March. So what are they waiting for in terms of decision-making?
Yeah.
This is a thing.
Yeah, that's a good point. That didn't strike me when I was...
I actually had a correspondence briefly with the journalist who wrote the article because I was a little unclear. I saw the 2015 thing. I didn't quite see the May thing. I added the 2021 to that for clarity. But it's like, yeah, they're talking like 2 months away to make a decision here. That's, I mean, politically and logistically, that's really weird.
Yeah, the implementation of presumably the final thing they need to do, which is the distribution circuits transitioning in May, and they're still waiting on like the final decisions. I hope they've gotten some of the work done already, or otherwise they're going to miss their deadline.
I'm kind of thinking an electric version of Flint, Michigan. Just, you know, the water thing.
Yeah.
Okay, last story for this segment. The percent of Texans vaccinated against COVID-19 now exceeds the percent who have tested positive. On March 14th, at least 9.8% of people in Texas were fully vaccinated against COVID-19, exceeding the percent who have tested positive for the virus. Meanwhile, as cases and hospitalization levels decline across Texas, testing rates are dropping too, which is not necessarily a good thing. Experts are not surprised that the demand for testing has decreased as people get vaccinated. Texans over 50 and older can get vaccinated starting March 15th. The statewide mask mandate and capacity limits on businesses both ended, but Austin can keep enforcing its local mask mandate until a trial is set on Attorney General Ken Paxton's attempt to block the rule, because Republicans are very big on local rule unless they are ruling. Elsewhere, school boards, courts, and college campuses can require masks. I know that Texas A&M is still requiring masks. So, but unfortunately, now you don't have the cover of a state mandate, and they have to start fighting with obstreperous individuals personally.
Right. And, you know, this is already in a situation where people were already getting into fights with like store employees over wearing masks and
stuff. There's been at least one shooting. Security guard was shot.
Yeah. And now they don't even have the ability to say, look, you know, it's a statewide mandate. Because, you know, there are going to be people who just won't respect the fact that the store or campus or whatever has the right to say you have to wear a mask. There are people
when you talk about stores or businesses versus campuses, that gets more complicated because at least a store you can rely on, hey, this is a private business on private property.
Yeah.
I don't know how much it would help, but at least you can rely on that.
Yeah.
But when you start talking campuses, well, if it's a state campus, do you follow the state mandate repeal or do you follow the president of the campus's rule?
Mm.
So that starts to become now a little bit more contentious. It was a bad idea. And it's like, couldn't they wait like 4 weeks?
Yeah.
4 weeks when you get so many more people vaccinated. It's like, no, we have to do it now to stick a finger in the eye of Joe Biden.
Yeah.
That's kind of what it comes down to.
Mm.
Okay, you're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Honig on KPFT Houston 90.1 FM. My co-host, my agreeable co-host, is Andrew Ferguson. You can find links to all the articles we talk about on any given show at the blog, thinkwingradio.com. You can podcast Think Wing Radio. So, did you hear my cat?
I heard your cat. Our friend at home probably heard your cat as well.
I am sure. She's such a sweet girl, but she wants her treats. In any case, you can also follow Andrew. Andrew, where do they follow you?
They follow me at DominateEYE on Twitter, and spelled the same, DominateEye.tumblr.com.
And it's kind of funny how both of us can forget where people are supposed to follow us.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I'm just too distracted by your cat.
Yes. Meow.
Yeah.
What am I doing? Oh, God. The fun and hassle of working from home. Also, I should mention, while we're on the break, you can go to kpft.org. We can, or rather, you can click on the donate link. I don't know that we can click. I mean, I guess we could.
Oh, we could.
You can click on the donate link, and if you are in a position to help out KPFT, it's a community-supported station. Whatever amount you can afford, whether it's a couple of bucks or something bigger, we greatly appreciate it. You can also support KPFT by texting to 713-526-5738. Text the word GIVE, and it'll take you through an automated process. You don't even have to deal with human beings anymore because we are advancing as a civilization. Okay, Joe Biden will deploy FEMA to care for teenagers and children crossing the border in record numbers. This is from the Washington Post by way of the Texas Tribune. The deployment will support what the Department of Homeland Security called a 90-day government-wide effort at the border, where the Biden administration is struggling to care for a record number of teenagers and children arriving without their parents. The federal government is responding to the arrival of record numbers of individuals, according to DHS. Conditions inside U.S. border stations have deteriorated in recent days, according to lawyers who represent migrant children, becoming dangerously overcrowded with nearly 4,000 minors who are jam-packed in holding facilities and jail cells designed for adults. Another 8,500 teens and children are in Health and Human Services custody, awaiting placement with parents or other relatives already living in the United States. I will add that there have been articles saying that the Biden administration will not do any kind of investigation into people that come forward as family to take care of these children. It won't be that all of a sudden they're going to be risking their status in the United States, legal or otherwise. Soon after taking office, President Biden said his administration, well, actually, here it is, would no longer turn back unaccompanied minors who cross the border without their parents, a policy the Trump, I will say, regime implemented using an emergency health order. Biden officials have not said why they did not anticipate or better prepare for the unprecedented surge, where as many as 700 teens and children have crossed without parents in recent days. DHS continues to use the public health order to, quote, expel single adults and some of the families that have also begun arriving in soaring numbers. Last month, border agents made more than 100,000 arrests and detentions along the border, and this month they are on pace to make more than 130,000, to take rather more than 130,000 into custody. The latest HHS and DHS statistics show about 75% of the minors are ages 15 to 17, but some are age 6 or even younger, and specialized care is required when they are placed, which places significant strain on federal agencies. Mm. The expel public health order has to do with COVID, mm-hmm. that there are people who have a legitimate refugee status that they can claim, other people do not. So we're kind of reverting to the pre-Trump immigration at the border rules. Mm-hmm. And, you know, this is all this and many other things from the past 4 years are going to take a while to sort out. And
Absolutely. There had been some, criticism of Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez when she said something on Twitter about, we need to make sure that there's more room for, there's more facilities to hold kids at the border, which, and obviously I can't quote it verbatim, which sounds bad on its own considering she's opposed, you know, more holding facilities for children. But the rest of the tweet thread made it clear that she was talking about like places they can actually go and be sheltered and be safe rather than cages, you know?
Yeah, there's Trump era detention and there's post-Trump era detention, hopefully.
Hopefully, yeah. There's also pre-Trump era detention, which was largely Trump era detention, but more brazen.
Well, the Trump era detention, and I mean, we don't necessarily want to get into a long discussion of this, but the Trump era detention was to deliberately separate parents and children, to act as a deterrent, to make absolutely no plan for reuniting them. So, you know, while the rules in place may have been the same, they were implemented drastically differently.
The material conditions were the same, but the rules were different. But like you said, the, you know, forcible separation, the rule there was different.
I think there was also a time limit for detention that was observed more correctly pre-Trump, whereas, you know, now you're talking months.
I could definitely see that.
It was, I think, a couple of weeks before.
Right. And you know, obviously, my own personal belief is, you know, there should be no cages at the border anyway. But obviously, any kind of shelters set up for kids that come across illegally or unlawfully or undocumented, that's the term I'm trying to
remember. Well, unlawfully is fair. I mean, if they're undocumented, it's unlawful.
That's true. But anyway, any shelters, you know, should be of, you know, humane living conditions. Exactly. You know, if a and I think
they're not,
you know,
a third world country. They should be treated as if they're in detention in a first world country.
Right. They should have the, you know, same freedoms and rights that all people have in the U.S. You know, if a person on a visa would be able to leave and go to the store and get a drink, you know, maybe they need to take a chaperone with them, but, you know, they should be able to go do that. A soda drink.
What's kind of interesting, and which I didn't know until the Trump era, is that the justice system or the legal system for illegal immigrants, mm-hmm. whatever term you care to use, is not under the Department of Justice.
Right. Yeah.
It's under immigration.
Yeah.
So you don't have the same, I mean, you can have 2-year-old children who can't even hardly speak Spanish or English that are given their rights. Do you understand your rights? Well, they're 2 years old. Of course they don't understand their rights. They don't always have lawyers. So, I mean, that is a system in and of itself that needs drastic reconsideration.
Right.
What should their rights be? Who should be authority? Should it be the Justice Department? Should it be some different branch of the executive? But what should the rules be, and how far should they depart from the rights of anybody within the borders of the United States? You know, if you're an illegal immigrant and you are arrested for a crime, I believe it is my understanding you are still entitled to go through the justice system before you are deported as an illegal immigrant.
Right.
So where do these rights start and end? I mean, that's a real thing.
Those
and
are
it's
the
not
questions.
Touched on in this article, but it's a real thing.
Absolutely.
Okay, next story. Do you remember Fukushima? Do you remember what Fukushima is? Do you remember the biggest nuclear accident since Chernobyl? Mm. Ah, well, it's the 10th anniversary of that one. From AP News, how dangerous is the Fukushima nuke plant today? After a magnitude 9.0 earthquake on March 11, 2011, a tsunami 17 meters or 56 feet high slammed into the Fukushima Daiichi Coastal Nuclear Power Plant, destroying its power supply and cooling systems and causing meltdowns in three reactors. The plant's other three reactors were offline and survived. A fourth building, along with two of the three melted reactors, had hydrogen explosions because apparently the water dissociates from the heat and, you know, oxygen, hydrogen, Hindenburg. Proper equipment has now replaced ragged plastic hoses held together with tape and an outdoor power switchboard infested by rats, which cause blackouts, but radiation levels have declined, allowing workers and visitors to wear regular clothes and surgical masks in most areas. But deep inside the plant, danger still lurks. Officials don't know exactly how long the cleanup will take, whether it will be successful, and what might become of the land where the plant sits. About 900 tons of melted nuclear fuel, which I recently learned has a name, it's called corium. Melted nuclear fuel is now known as corium.
Huh.
See what you learn. Officials say it will take 30 to 40 years to remove. Critics say that's overly optimistic. Removing spent fuel from cooling pools inside the reactor buildings has been delayed up to 5 years. If the plant's pools lose their cooling water in another major quake, the exposed fuel rods could overheat and cause an even worse meltdown. The melted cores in units 1, 2, and 3 mostly fell to the bottom of their primary vessels, mixing with the concrete foundation, making removal extremely difficult. Think of the movie Philadelphia Experiment, where the sailors became merged with the steel deck. This is kind of what we're dealing with. That, of course, was fiction. This is not. Contaminated cooling water has constantly escaped from the damaged primary containment vessels into the reactor building basements, where it mixes with groundwater that seeps in. The water is pumped up and treated. Part is recycled as cooling water. The remainder is stored in 1,000 huge tanks. Tiny amounts of radiation have continued leaking into the sea and elsewhere through underground passages, though the amount today is small, and fish caught off the coast are safe to eat, scientists say. I trust scientists, but not necessarily government scientists in certain circumstances. TEPCO, Tokyo Electric Power Company, says the tank's 1.37 million ton storage capacity will fill by 2020 or in 2022. A government panel's recommendation that water be released into the sea is facing fierce opposition from local residents, especially fishermen, concerned about further damage to the area's reputation. 10 years on, Japan does not have a plan to dispose of the highly radioactive melted fuel, debris, and waste at the plant. Remember now, even the concrete becomes radioactive waste. Everything in the plant is radioactive waste. Technology also isn't advanced enough yet to manage the waste by reducing its toxicity. There are about 500,000 tons of solid radioactive waste, including contaminated debris, soil, sludge from water treatment, scrap tanks, and other waste. It's unclear what the plant will look like when the work there is done. Local officials and residents say they expect the complex one day to be open space where they can walk freely, but there's no clear idea if or when that might happen. I might also point out that Chernobyl currently is open space where people can walk freely. It's just radioactive.
True.
So I've done a lot of commentary in the course of reading this. Andrew, your turn.
Yeah, it is open space where people can walk freely. It is still irradiated, though. But somehow, I don't think that's exactly what the person being interviewed meant in this case. But, I mean, this is... For people who kind of don't understand the fears that people have about nuclear power and nuclear missiles, importantly, this is the kind of stuff that I hope gives y'all an understanding of why people have those apprehensions. Because when this stuff happens, it is deadly, it is persistent, it does not go away easily.
It's like a big meteor strike. It doesn't have to happen often to be worrisome.
Exactly. And, you know,
for and what we've learned from Three Mile Island, Chernobyl, and Fukushima, about every 20, 30 years, apparently, on average, we're having nuclear accidents.
Right. And whether in money or resources or both, it's expensive as well to deal with. And, you know, that puts stress on economies. And, you know, there are good reasons to be wary. You know, I personally, I'm undecided about, you know, nuclear power. I'm anti-nuclear weapons, but I'm undecided about nuclear power. I think the advantages and disadvantages, well, I may not understand them well enough to have an opinion. But
now, this is interesting because in contrast to you, I have come out at this point against nuclear power as the current technology is designed.
Right. And I think
that there are a lot of technologies that are kind of in the investigation stage and the testbed stage, and some of those look really interesting.
Yeah.
But the current technology, I am against.
Yeah. Certainly, I think that's probably a position that I also take. I was more talking about, but I think when people say they're against nuclear power, it's either taken or they mean it, that they are just against any nuclear power, no matter what the level of technology is.
And for some people, that fear is something that's developed over time.
Right.
It's going to be hard to counteract. I mean, kind of like you mentioned earlier in the show about vaccines.
Right, right.
That has to be overcome with good information.
Exactly. I would be more than willing to support nuclear power if I knew it was safe, if I knew there was an ecologically sound way to deal with the waste. But, you know, we don't have that to a satisfactory degree yet. So, any degree, really. Yeah.
I mean, really, it's the French vitrify it, turning it into glass and burying it. In the United States, we either store it in corroding barrels or we try to inject it into salt domes. One of the more interesting concepts, and I think it's something that maybe Gates is involved with, Bill Gates, is a kind of nuclear power that would actually be fueled by current nuclear waste. In other words, that low-level radioactivity could act as the fuel for a nuclear reactor and then be turned into even lower-level radioactive waste. So, I mean, there's stuff that can be done, but, you know, we need to move on. Time is pushing. You know, Brexit. Was it ever a good idea? So here's an article from... here's an article from Reuters. Irish foreign minister says the UK is guilty of perverse nationalism over US trade. Ireland's foreign minister said Saturday that Britain was demonstrating perverse nationalism by seeking to reach a trade deal with the US before the European Union and questioned whether UK was a trustworthy partner. This idea that Britain can get there first is narrow-minded thinking, frankly, said Foreign Minister Simon Coveney. It's a perverse nationalism when actually Britain and the EU should work together as partners, he said in an interview. And of course, Ireland is part of the EU, so that would be inclusive. Coveney advocated Britain working with the EU and Canada to reach a joint trade deal with the United States, although the EU does not currently have plans for a major US trade deal. He also questioned Britain's trustworthiness following its plans to unilaterally delay imposing checks required by the Brexit deal on some food products traveling from England, Scotland, or Wales to Northern Ireland. Brexit was just such a bad idea.
It really was.
And even now, a lot of English, and I say English is distinct from British, are finding that, for example, it's decimating their fishing industry because of the complications of getting seafood into the EU. It's just such a self-inflicted wound. You're listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT Houston, 90.1 FM, with my co-host Andrew Ferguson. You can listen online, live, at kpft.org. You can also go to archive.kpft.org in order to listen to shows that are previously broadcast. This show stays online for about 8 weeks. I also upload them to my website, thinkwingradio.com. And of course, there's the donate link for kpft.org. I think you guys probably know about that by now. I will say this. If you are not in a position or of an inclination currently to donate money to kpft.org, you know the second most important thing you can do, and it's a close second, tell people about it. Tell friends about it. Word of mouth. If there are shows you like, recommend them. If there are topics you like that are covered, tell people about it. Let people know that the station is on the air. Some people don't even realize that we're on the air anymore. So help us out just by talking, kind of like me. Well, not necessarily like me, and not necessarily even like Andrew, just sort of how you do. Okay, an interesting piece here. Syria's Asma al-Assad faces police investigation in the UK. A law firm has brought a case alleging the wife of the Syrian president, Bashar al-Assad, incited and encouraged terrorist acts in Syria. Police in the UK have opened an investigation into allegations that Asma al-Assad, wife of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, incited and encouraged terrorist acts in Syria. Asma al-Assad, a dual British-Syrian national, could be stripped of her UK citizenship if convicted of the crime, according to media reports. What she is suspected of doing is having incited acts that have resulted in death in Syria, according to Toby Cadman, founder of Guernica 37. Meeting with troops, making public statements, glorifying conduct of the army that has resulted in 500,000 deaths, and the use of chemical and other forms of banned weapons. It is not just that she is the wife of the president. Our allegations are she has actively campaigned and actively participated in those crimes, and so she must face justice, he said. It could result in the stripping of her citizenship. We, of course, don't want that to happen. We want her to face trial. Andrew?
Well, this poses an interesting hypothetical question. For world leaders who are dual citizens, once they're out of office or even while they're in office, can the nation that they are a dual citizen of, that they don't rule, bring charges up against them based off of the things they do in office? Because if that's the case, UK Prime Minister Boris Johnson is a dual American citizen. He was born in New York, American-British citizen. So theoretically, if Biden was feeling a little bit vindictive for old Boris helping out Trump so much, he could bring charges against Boris in the U.S.
Theoretically. I'm not sure what he would bring charges for specifically, but theoretically. Right. It's also worth noting that there are a number of leaders around the world, even in Europe, that are dual citizens. Sometimes they're Canadian dual citizens, U.S. dual citizens. Sometimes you've got Central Asian leaders who have been naturalized in the U.S. or elsewhere. And it's you start to wonder about, okay, are certain countries members of the International Court in The Hague? Is there a country that can indict them for something and put out an arrest warrant to bring them to The Hague? I mean, in a sense, if this is something that can actually be done in the UK against Asma al-Assad, it kind of opens up new legal territory that maybe hasn't been contemplated before.
True, true. It may be slightly different because she was not the actual leader of the country, but she was a key figure.
So last week, there was a referendum in Switzerland where voters supported a ban on face coverings in public. This is from the BBC. Switzerland narrowly voted in favor of banning face coverings in public, including the burqa or niqab worn by Muslim women. If I'm mispronouncing that, forgive me. Official results showed the measure passed 51.2 to 48.8 in Sunday's referendum, last Sunday's. The proposal was put forward by the right-wing Swiss People's Party, which campaigned with slogans such as Stop Extremism. A little ironic from the right-wing Swiss People's Party. A leading Swiss Islamic group said it was a dark day for Muslims. The irony here is that, I mean, this is kind of interesting. We've talked a number of times about changes that COVID has brought to societies. You know, a year ago, a year and a half ago, people in the West would say, well, we should be able to identify people. We should be able to tell if maybe a male terrorist is dressed in a burqa to hide the fact that he's a male and has nefarious things in mind. And now it's like we're all supposed to be wearing masks. It kind of invalidates, potentially, the notion that, you know, should we consider whether Muslim women should be concealing themselves when, in fact, they might be planning something nefarious, when, in fact, everybody is supposed to be wearing a mask and the lower half of everybody's face is supposed to be covered, theoretically. which poses us essentially with the same problem for everyone.
Yeah.
So a year ago, this might have had a different complexion, to use a word, whereas now it's after a year of society under COVID, it kind of has a different calculus. Now, what makes this story sort of interesting is there has also been a new rule promulgated in Sri Lanka, a proposal to ban the burqa in Sri Lanka, viewed by many as an attempt to appease Sri Lanka's Buddhist majority and cause divisions. This is from Al Jazeera. Sri Lanka's move to ban the burqa on national security grounds, while calling its use religious extremism, has been termed a racist agenda used to cause divisions in the country. A burqa is an outer garment worn to cover the entire body and face and is used by some Muslim women. On Saturday, Sri Lanka's Minister for Public Security said he had signed a paper for cabinet approval to ban the burqa, adding that the government also plans to ban more than 1,000 Islamic schools that were defying national education policy. Sri Lankans expressed disapproval of the proposal, with many viewing the act as an attempt to appease Sri Lanka's Buddhist majority and cause divisions, which again goes back to the national security question. I mean, aside from the banning of Muslim schools, and I mean, you know, there's like a whole separate conversation around that, promulgating extremism or whatever, but hiding the face as a national security concern or a general security concern, how do we view that after a year of people being told they should wear masks?
Yeah. It to be honest, like, my opinion on these kinds of face covering bans has always been that they're just racist.
Well, you realize in France, it's a matter of secularism, enforced secularism. I mean, even more so than constitutional separation of church and state.
Right. Yeah. And it's religious discrimination as well. It's Islamophobia.
It's anti-religious of any religion.
Yes. But I think it's fair to say that there are stereotypes at play here, and those are Islamophobic stereotypes. I mean, and this is this sort of the new reality we live under COVID just kind of further proves the point that, like, banning face coverings is, you know, for one reason, but enforcing them for another reason is pretty hypocritical and, you know, just it's bad public policy. You know, there was, I know you mentioned this, you know, slightly, but, you know, the banning of the Islamic schools as well as, you know, tying these two policies together in Sri Lanka is kind of a good indicator to me that this has roots in Islamophobia.
Yeah, it's not like they're saying we need to be able to see your face so we can identify if you commit something illegal.
Right.
It's like, we want to be able to identify you when, oh, by the way, we're banning 1,000 religious schools.
Right. Now, it says
that's a suspicious sort of synchronicity.
Right. It says they were defying national education policy, but it doesn't say whether the national education policy was don't say anything good about Islam. Right.
So, yeah, to be fair, the article wasn't specific in that sense.
Right. But, you know, so it's there is the potential maybe that, you know, the schools should have had some kind of, you know, something to bring them in line with the national education policy, assuming the policy is fair. But if the policy isn't fair, then no, forget it. And banning them is probably a bit much as well.
I think, you know, differences between you and I, aside from the political, aside from the philosophical, is the chronological.
Mm-hmm.
And one thing I've noticed with my stepdaughter, who is just going to turn 30, dealing with that, she has a totally different way of seeing the world. You know, I was born, I mean, I hate to say it, I was born in the middle of the last century.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Literally that, 51. And I have had to adapt to a changing world. I've had to learn, I've had to evolve, I've had to reconsider. Whereas my stepdaughter, who is 30, she was born into a world that I was already having to try to evolve to.
Right.
She sees things completely differently. One of the things that struck me when she was in high school, you know, I might refer to, if I'm like trying to define a group and pick out an individual in a group, it's not like boxing where you say the solid trunks, the striped trunks, right? It was like the kid with the long hair, the black kid, the Hispanic kid, the Asian kid. She doesn't even see people in those terms. And, you know, I can't wrap my head around that. I just have to kind of learn it and accept it. So young people today who are experiencing the masking from COVID, either the very young or the reasonably young teenagers, maybe early 20s, you know, by the time they get to my age or even your age, their perspective of the world will be completely different. Mm. The extent to which they'll simply accept something versus having to adapt to it will be completely different.
Right.
And, you know, sometimes generational change takes a generation for a reason.
True.
You know,
true.
There's an expression, Jack McDivitt, an author of science fiction, I once heard him make a remark that civilization advances one funeral at a time.
Mm.
And yeah. It's basically morbid, but true.
Yeah. I would also say not pointing something out doesn't mean you don't see it, but it is a deliberate choice not to point it out. So your original point still stands.
Okay. Well, thank you. we're going to wrap up on a little lighter note. A story from from Slate.com. Dr. Seuss's name rhymes with voice. Yes, it's Dr. Seuss. Yes, you've been pronouncing it wrong your whole life. The question facing America is not, no matter what Fox News or CNN or other news outlets might claim, it is not, is Dr. Seuss being canceled? He's not. Mm-mm. The question facing America is, have you been pronouncing Dr. Seuss's name wrong for your entire life? The answer to that question is yes, you have. Dr. Seuss does not rhyme with goose. Dr. Seuss is a German name with a German pronunciation that rhymes with Joyce. Apparently, he took it from his middle name, which was his mother's maiden name. So he wrote it thinking it was Dr. Seuss. We all just said it wrong, and he just didn't bother to correct us. Okay, you've been listening to Think Wing Radio with Mike Koenig on KPFT 90.1 FM. My very flexible, reasonable, forgiving editor is Andrew Ferguson. We will be back next week, hopefully entertaining, hopefully informative, and hopefully on time. Everyone have a great week. Bye-bye.
Storm. Why don't we cross the bridge together and find the place that's safe and warm? It's not too late. We should be giving. Only with love can we climb. It's not too late.
One in nine Americans listens to a local public radio station on a regular basis. Many use stations like KPFT to make voting decisions, music choices, their own conclusions about the world, or where to go over the weekend. That's because less than 0.5% of programming on commercial stations goes to local public affairs. Why not consider supporting KPFT as a major donor? Whether as an individual or an organization, major donors help KPFT in many ways. Major donors help big station projects and ensure KPFT gets the money it needs to survive without all those pledges. Drives. Just call our development director at 713-526-4000 to become a major donor today. Your donation of $5,000 or more helps keep independent arts, music, news, and views alive and kicking on the Gulf Coast. Become a KPFT major donor today. Call our development director at 713-526-4000 to join KPFT's major donor program. KPFT is indispensable, but we need you to keep our blood pumping. This is KPFT Houston, Texas.